I think the technology is untested in this environment, and I think it's a question of whether it will cause damage to the tundra and the permafrost.
Congressional leaders reject another ANWR drilling attempt. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 9th of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a report that says healthcare reform could help the economy.
We can find a way to both save consumers money and still do some of the things that need correcting, like insuring more people and creating jobs.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Operating a forklift is serious business, and operators are required to be properly trained and certified. The emotional and financial damage can be severe when a family member never comes home from work or comes home with a debilitating injury due to a forklift accident. Training information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
The Senate Energy Committee tackled the oil and gas part of its massive energy bill in Washington today. Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski tried and failed to rally support for directional drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Senator Murkowski's ANWR amendment fell short on a vote of 13 to 10, with one Republican, Senator John McCain of Arizona, voting against it, and one Democrat, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, crossing over to support it. Murkowski tried to convince the rest of the committee's Democrats that her proposal for directional drilling is different than the scores of past efforts to open the Arctic refuge.
Mr. Chairman, I also know what the definition of insanity is, and that's when you keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. I'm expecting to get a different result. I am not advancing an ANWR amendment that opens up the whole coastal plain. What I am proposing is an amendment that would allow us to use our technology to take the resource from under the land without disturbing the surface.
Murkowski's proposal would only allow drilling outside the refuge in state lands, siphoning the oil from underneath the ground. She did concede that it would require testing in the area, which environmentalists are opposed to. But Murkowski says she's a believer in the technology.
Some out there have called this a Trojan's horse, that what we're going to do is, you know, we're gonna march in under false pretenses and somehow or other change the rules of the game. I don't have any intention of doing that.
The committee's chairman and top Democrat, Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico, says directional drilling in ANWR is a legitimate topic when crafting an energy bill, but ultimately voted against it. Washington State Senator Maria Cantwell summed up the opinions of many Democrats on the committee.
I think the technology is untested in this environment, and I think it's a question of whether it will cause damage to the tundra and the permafrost. And it's still going to include massive drilling in an industrial complex to be on the western border of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, which we as a country have decided for many years that we want to protect.
Even though Murkowski's plans for the Arctic Refuge were shot down, she did get support for an amendment relating to the eventual dismantling of the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline. Murkowski expressed concerns that when the line reaches 50 years of age, it will qualify under current law for historic preservation. She says that could crimp plans to build part of a natural gas pipeline in the oil pipeline's corridor.
Wouldn't it be bizarre if in an effort to comply with this National Historic Bill, that we would not be able to site a natural gas pipeline in that same corridor because it would be obstructing the view of this historic pipeline. So I'm trying to eliminate a little bit of the confusion that could be raised.
Murkowski's amendment designates three segments of pipeline for historic preservation and allows the rest of it to be dismantled. The original pipeline legislation said the 800-mile line would be taken apart once the oil runs dry. Murkowski has also won bipartisan support for provisions that would help finance an Alaska natural gas pipeline. They've been included in the main text of the oil and gas part of the energy bill, and no one contested them at the markup. Debate will continue on Thursday. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Outside the Energy Committee and across the aisle, Murkowski has a supporter for her pipeline loan guarantees measure. Alaska's junior senator, Democrat Mark Magich, has been talking them up to members of his party.
As we continue to move forward on it, some of these provisions that she's getting in there are going to be a huge plus. The question is, when do we see an energy bill? It's going through its own process. It's going to still take some time.
Begich stepped into a fray over the pipeline last week when he criticized what he called a lack of progress on a proposed plan. Governor Palin's office struck back, with some of her commissioners slamming Begich, claiming he wasn't keeping up to speed on pipeline progress. Begich says his comments last week have done some good. He says it's helped raise a gas line's profile. The senator says he does not want the federal government to nationalize a gas line, as some of his opponents have claimed. Instead, Begich says he wants to see it as part of a national energy vision.
I want gas to be right up there, and then, obviously, I'm biased. I want them to say Alaska gas. So part of bringing this attention that we've done in the last week has now caused this discussion. Exactly what I wanted. And it's not about nationalizing. It's about bringing national attention to the prospects of Alaska gas being part of the energy policy of this country.
As for the conflicting comments between Begich and Governor Palin, he says it's gotten national press coverage for the gas line story.
You know, someone said, well, you're in a dust-up with the governor. I said, no, I'm not. Here's what I'm talking about. Well, now it's part of the national discussion, and that's good.
President Obama has called an Alaska gas line promising and talked about it during his campaign as being part of a comprehensive energy strategy. A report released today says that improvements in the nation's healthcare system will also translate into improvements in the economy. The Alaska Public Interest Research Group, AGPIRG, says controlling costs and expanding the system would translate into 5,885 new jobs in the state over 5 years and put more than $5 million into the state's economy. AGPIRG Executive Director Gabe Acevis says that's based on national studies that show a $500,000 jobs would be created with healthcare reform.
That basically is the result of a reduction in the growth of healthcare spending by about 1.5% each year. And so through that decrease in spending from hospitals, clinics, health insurance companies, it's going to allow everyone in the healthcare field to staff up in areas that they need, or to hire workers to do things like the modernization of the healthcare records, or to staff up on their nursing shortages, or to staff the ERs, which are currently understaffed.
Aceva says the report does not reflect any particular approach to change, and neither AGPIRG nor the national USPIRG favors any single plan over any other. He says the study points to the need for action on the issue of reducing high health costs. He says that health insurance rates are estimated to double in the next decade if the public doesn't do something now.
There's big changes that need to be made, and the good thing about it is that we can find a way to both save consumers and those of us who are insured money and still do some of the things that need correcting, like insuring more people and creating jobs and those things. They're all tied together, and I think we can find a solution.
Healthcare reform is currently a top issue for the Obama administration, and the subject is before the state legislature. A report from Families USA last year found that Alaska hospitals provided $125 million a year in uncompensated services for uninsured patients, and only about one-fifth of that is reimbursed by federal, state, or local governments. Senator Hollis French, who has sponsored a state health insurance system, says that hospitals don't lose that money. He says they increase the charges for insured patients, continuing the rising spiral of health care costs for everyone. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, high-speed fiber optics head for more bush communities.
Combination of good burial and careful attention to the local knowledge, and we're working with the pilots and some of the fishing groups that know the water the best.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the UAF College of Engineering and Mines, providing early registration for fall engineering classes at 1-877-474-7390. Information at uaf.edu/cem. And by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
A wildfire in the western interior is encroaching on the Upper Kuskokwim River village of Talida. Southwest District State Fire Management Officer Jeff Brown says strong winds fueled a major run by the Tunklanoka Foot Creek fire last night.
Currently, the northern perimeter is about 2 miles south of Talida. We have 8 smoke jumpers in Talida. We put them in late last night. And we have a Type 3 management team en route, as well as 2 hand crews. And our intent is to fortify the defenses around Talida and construct some hand lines, some saw lines, lay some hose lays and pumps, and protect the community.
Talida is home to just 3 people, but Brown says there are more than a dozen buildings, including a school, in the community. Aerial retardant drops were halted and crews pulled from the fire front last night due to extreme conditions. The Tunklanoka Creek fire, which is estimated at more than 16,000 acres, was started last month by lightning. Southwest winds are blowing smoke from the Tunklanoka blaze across the interior. State Division of Forestry spokeswoman Maggie Rogers says the development of large fires in the region means there will be a high potential for smoke.
We do have several lightning-caused fires that are established in the southern, eastern, and western portions of the state, and we can expect these fires to continue to grow throughout the summer. And depending on which way the winds are coming and the weather conditions, we can experience smoke. There is that potential.
Meteorologists say conditions are typically worse in the morning when inversions trap smoke at ground level. The Juneau School Board is considering drug testing high school students in athletics and activities. The issue has emerged from growing concerns about prescription drug abuse among students. Elsewhere in Southeast, Sitka and Ketchikan schools already randomly test participants in extracurricular programs. KTOO's Rebecca Shear reports on the legal implications of implementing a similar policy in the capital city.
Among the community members most in favor of mandatory random drug testing are Juneau's high school coaches. One of them, Juneau Douglas football head Bill Chalmers, went so far as to warn the school board that he might resign if testing isn't put in place. But not all the coaches are quite as gung-ho.
I'm Gary Lanehart, and I think this is my 16th year of coaching soccer.
As a coach at JDHS, Lanehart understands how drug abuse can harm athletes.
You know them sometimes since they were 8, 9 years old. So as I watch some of these kids throughout my program and I watch what drugs has done to them, to not do something to try to help them just doesn't make sense.
But as a teacher of government and law, when he considers drug testing in schools,
I think it's an invasion of their privacy. I really do.
Technically, the U.S. Supreme Court considers drug testing of students through urinalysis a search. And of course, for a government search to be legal,
so take out your constitutions. Let me give you the handout.
It has to comply with the U.S. Constitution, more specifically, with a little something called the Fourth Amendment. And as Lanehart noted in a recent U.S. government class, the point of the Fourth Amendment
is to protect people's privacy. From who?
The government.
From the government. Give me examples of the government that you're being protected from. You're looking at one.
Schools.
Yeah. Teachers. Administrators. So this school drug testing possibility is about whether or not your school can choose to violate your privacy.
Federal law decides whether a search is reasonable by weighing its invasion of personal privacy against its advancement of public interest. A 1985 U.S. Supreme Court case ruled that student searches are permissible only if school officials possess a reasonable suspicion that the search will reveal evidence of rule violations or illegal activity. And Lanehart's colleague, Leslie Dahl,
I'm head coach for the Juneau Douglas High School dance team,
believes rule violations and illegal activity abound when it comes to drug use among Juneau's youth.
I think epidemic is a pretty good description. I hardly can talk to anybody anymore that hasn't had a close personal situation, either a family member or a close friend or an athlete that they've coached or something that has had problems.
Which is why Dahl has joined forces with other coaches and community members in Taking Action, a grassroots effort urging the school board to implement random drug testing. Joining her is JDHS women's basketball coach Leslie Knight.
I interviewed 100 students just to see where they were at. Of the juniors and seniors, 100% said they knew someone in activity using. I also at that time interviewed a player currently in a sport who has used drugs and alcohol during a season, and I asked him, if you had known ahead of time you would be drug tested, would you have used? And he said, no.
Dahl and Knight know that some people worry about drug testing and personal privacy.
I've heard a lot of arguments about civil liberties and things.
But Dahl believes the law is on her side.
Supreme Court decision covers athletics in high school, so you can win that argument.
And technically, she's right. 1995's Vernonia School District versus Acton is the first case in which the highest court in the land approved random drug testing in schools.
An Oregon school district, Vernonia, essentially decided it had a problem. They had done an anonymous survey, and the numbers came back saying that, one, they had a drug problem, and two, that students in athletics seemed to be more involved in that problem than others. So they instituted drug testing.
And as Gary Lanehart explains, 5 years later, in Earls versus Tecumseh Public School District, the court upheld mandatory random drug testing for students in any extracurricular activity.
Not just athletics, anybody in activities.
But as he's ever so quick to point out,
one justice switched. Justice Ginsburg went from the majority to the minority, so now it's 5-4, so it's even closer. So clearly this is an issue that's divided.
Of course, Lanehart is divided as well. But when it all comes down to it, he says what it's really about is doing what's best for Juno's kids.
We can't just sit idly by making our little speeches, showing our little films, signing our little contracts, and put our heads in the sand and the kids will stop doing this. If we do institute drug testing, it'll be controversial. And by some, it'll be seen as a panacea. But we got to try. We got to try something.
In Juno, I'm Rebecca Shear.
The company that brought high-speed fiber optic telecommunications to Kodiak is planning an expansion. As Jay Barrett of KMXT reports, fiber optic service will now extend to Southwest, Western, and Arctic Alaska.
Kodiak Kenai Cable Company, jointly owned by the Old Harbor and Uzinki Native Corporations, now plans to run a fiber optic cable from Kodiak to Dutch Harbor and then back up to Bristol Bay and along the coast, ultimately winding up in Prudhoe Bay. Ike Eichard with the Great Pacific Cable Company is designing the project for KKCC. He says the line will stretch over 3,400 miles and make landfall at the larger communities along the way, such as Dutch Harbor, Cold Bay, Naknek, Dillingham, Bethel, Nome, Kotzebue, and Barrow. He says a submarine cable is far more feasible than trying to bring the same bandwidth over land.
It really doesn't make sense. I mean, you know better than I some of the ideas that have been floated to build roads out and stuff, and it's a very difficult proposition. It certainly makes an awful lot more sense to come into the major communities from the water side as opposed to the land side and then build out your infrastructure from those cable heads.
Kodiak Kenai Cable proposes to fund the Northern Fiber Link by using a National Telecommunications and Information Administration broadband grant authorized under the federal stimulus program. In return, the company says it will offer, at no charge other than maintenance, bandwidth to the University of Alaska, National Science Foundation, Homeland Security, health corporations, and other nonprofits. Eichard designed the Kodiak Kenai Cable Company's first project, which strung two fiber optic lines from Kodiak to the mainland. The company is now building a microwave relay system to bring that same high-speed access to the villages of Kodiak Island. While stringing cable to Kodiak is no small feat, Eichard said it went extremely smoothly and expects the Northern Fiber Link to be the same despite a different set of unique challenges along the route.
We're dealing with over a significant portion of the project, really some shallow water approaches to landing and some shallow water transits, for instance, up into Dillingham. And with a combination of good burial and careful attention to local knowledge, and we're working with the pilots and some of the fishing groups that know the water the best, both to coordinate our work and our route with their fishing activities and then the areas that they fish the most heavily. We're confident we've got good solutions to get into to all of them, including the 80-90 mile run up to Bethel, as you point out, up the river.
Eichard says the first phase from Kodiak to Nome is expected to be laid next summer, with phase two from Nome to Dead Horse done in 2011. The line will have an initial capacity of 160 billion bits per second. almost the equivalent of 3 million dial-up modems. I'm Jay Barrett.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by the H1N1 swine flu has reached Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water, or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands, and stay home if you're sick. Contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
President Obama has announced his nominees to run the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bureau of Land Management. Sam Hamilton has worked for Fish and Wildlife for 3 decades. His selection to run the agency that oversees endangered species, fisheries, habitat conservation, and migratory bird hunting was announced today. He's a career senior biologist and currently serves as director of Fish and Wildlife's Southeast Region in Atlanta, Georgia. The president's nominee to head the Bureau of Land Management is Bob Abbey. He serves as the Nevada State Director for BLM and also oversaw the Great Basin Restoration Project, which worked to revitalize a series of watersheds in the western U.S. Both nominees to the Interior Department positions must be confirmed by the Senate. The quota for Opelio crab could be slashed this year. The total allowable catch might be drastically lowered from 58.6 million pounds last season to as low as 16 million pounds. This is the recommendation of the Crab Plan Team, which advises the North Pacific Fishery Management Council and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game on setting the total allowable catches for the crab fisheries. Fisheries biologist and plan team member Forrest Bowers says that when they met last month, they discuss the health of the Opelio stocks. Snow crabs were declared overfished in 1999, and fisheries managers implemented a 10-year-long rebuilding plan. This is the 8th year.
Based on all of the projections up until this point, we had been on track to be rebuilt within 10 years. However, after the most recent survey and most recent fishery, the stock status, trajectory changed a little bit, and so that derailed us.
Brower says the only way to get back on track is to seriously limit the fishing. Looking at current survey data and model projections, the stocks are about 60 million pounds too low. But Brower says the level changes each year depend on the summer stock surveys, which are finished in August. That means the cuts may not be so drastic. This summer's data will help them determine the total allowable catch, which will be announced in October. It's unclear what will happen if the fishery is not considered rebuilt by 2010. NOAA lawyers are trying to clarify what the Magnuson-Stevens Act says. If the snow crab catch is drastically cut, Bauer says the fleet will probably be much smaller and fish a much shorter season. It would also seriously impact Unalaska's income from the fish landing tax. Last year, the total ex-vessel value for the fishery was about $80 million. The Kodiak area commercial salmon season starts today, and while it's early for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to gauge how the season will play out in terms of effort levels and harvest, there is cause for optimism. KMXT's Eric Wander has more.
Fish and Game doesn't yet have enough information upon which to base a reliable forecast for the Kodiak area commercial salmon season. But area management biologist Jeff Wadley said the department will soon. Wadley said he expects effort to remain similar to that of last year, at least with regard to set netters.
We don't have any requirements for registrations, so I suspect we'll have similar effort levels for the set netters, but not really sure how many seiners we're going to have yet. I think the beginning, it probably will be pretty light. But I think once the pinks start running, we'll see a big pickup in seiners.
Wadley said Fish and Game starts managing for pink salmon in July, at the very beginning of the run, adding that pink numbers are expected to build up by the end of July and into August. He said last year was a particularly disappointing year for both sockeye and pinks.
Last year was a weak year for sockeye and pinks. I think the effort was similar to the year before, like around 158 boats or something like that. But we had a pretty poor year last year for pretty much all species.
Early indications suggest that this year will be similarly weak, at least for sockeye. But Wadley said Fish and Game has high hopes for pinks this season. He said last year about 8.7 million pink salmon were harvested, and that this year those numbers should rise dramatically.
The Karlik Run at this point seems to be pretty weak, and I haven't heard much anecdotal information about people seeing fish, so not really sure. That's kind of why we're doing this 33-hour fishing period, just to see what kind of runs that's coming through. As far as pinks go, though, it's going to be a big year. We're predicting about 22 million, so that's actually a pretty large forecast. Should be good for pinks this year, hopefully.
Wadley said Fish and Game will be able to gather significant information regarding run strength and effort levels during the initial 33-hour fishing period, which begins at noon in the Central and North Cape sections of the Northwest Kodiak District and in the Alitak District. He said that information will in turn go a long way toward predicting the course of the rest of the season.
I'll be able to look at the harvest and kind of gauge where the fish are moving, what kind of strength we're going to have on the west side, which is where we manage for Karlik Run. And then we'll also have a fishery on the south end of the island for the Olga Bay systems, and that'll tell me, again, what the strength of the run is going through the fishery. And it'll also give me a harvest effort from seiners and gill netters. Just looking at, you know, a daily harvest, you know, that'll tell me, you know, what kind of fish are moving through at any given time. So we're just kind of waiting and seeing right now.
Fish and Game's preliminary forecast for the pink salmon harvest in the Kodiak management area is about 22.1 million fish, a number well above last year's total harvest and just above the 10-year average. Sockeye numbers are expected to be about the same as last year, when roughly 1.8 million sockeye were harvested, significantly below the 10-year average. Also opening at noon today and remaining open until further notice are the Inner Kitoy, Outer Kitoy, Duck Bay, and Isuit sections of the Afognak District, as well as the Fowl Bay and Waterfall Bay special harvest areas. I'm Eric Wander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Rebecca Shear in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jay Barrett and Eric Wander in Kodiak, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. Our intern is Susanna Caldwell. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation.
And by
BP, giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home.
Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.